UK Wine Show, show number 173. Champagne Closures with Roger Bigot from Duval Loire. G'day, it's the 11th of September and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and on this week's show we're talking with Roger Bigot from Duval Loire. Roger is the export manager for Duval and he explains his new innovation in champagne closures. This week's been a fairly busy week with lots of tastings going on, which is always good. We've also been putting together loads of new dates for wine courses for next year. So if you get the newsletter, you'll be having the new dates coming through this week, as it's newsletter week. If you don't get the newsletter, it's not bad, and we have some great giveaways coming up in the next couple of months. So do drop us a line through the contact us section in our website and select newsletter. Fill in your name and details, and hey presto, you're set up to receive it. As a tip, the newsletter has the wine regions and grape varieties in it that we use for our mystery grape variety. So if you get the newsletter and you read that, you may have an edge in terms of working out what the mystery region is. And that's what it is this week. It's a mystery region. So let me give you the first clue of the mystery region. It was thought that vines were brought to the region in 1554 by settlers, partly so they could make wines to celebrate the Eucharist. Today, however, a different set of grape varieties are known. Rare grapes such as Cabernet Sauvignon, Carmenere, Merlot and Syrah dominate, but Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay are also important. Now, our mystery region is a 1,000-kilometre plateau, which is separated from the Pacific Ocean to the west by a low coastal range of peaks, and to the north by the mighty Andes, rising up to 6,000 metres. Vines are at altitudes up to 600 metres on the western slope, and up to 1,000 metres on the sunnier eastern slope. I'm going to give you more clues after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Cheers, Chris. Wine writers had their chance to shine this week at the 2009 Louis Roederer International Wine Writers Awards, which were held in London. Amongst the winners were Tim Atkin MW, who was awarded Wine Columnist of the Year, and Tom Stevenson for the Champagne Writer of the Year. Oz Clark won the International Wine Book for his book on Bordeaux, and Canadian wine writer Natalie McLean won the Online Wine Writer of the Year. The panel of judges included Victoria Moore, Simon Berry, who's chairman of Berry Brothers and Rudd, Tom Canavan, Andrew Jefford, and the panel chairman was Charles Metcalf.
Congratulations to all the winners. They all deserve their awards. What's next, Jane?
Well, celebrity chef Anthony Worrell Thompson is back in the news again. This time over his wine company, ADP Wines, which he set up originally to supply his own restaurant chain. As most of you will know, his restaurants went into administration in February this year, owing £800,000. But the administrators are now in dispute with his company, ADP Wines, over a £36,000 consignment of fine wine, to which ADP claim ownership. ADP continue to trade and supply three of the restaurants the chef has since reopened. The administrators at BHG's insolvency practitioners say they are taking legal advice to resolve the dispute.
It does raise an interesting dilemma. Is it right to protect yourself from your own failure by hiding behind business structures? Anthony is quoted as saying in the Sunday Times, "I am not directly involved in the situation and trying to put the administration behind me. I think if I cocked up so badly, I'd want to be involved in one of my companies and not try and put it behind me, but work through it. It's the suppliers to his restaurants I feel sorry for. They're likely to get a pittance of what's owed, but Anthony thinks he has the moral right to the full amount of money owned by one of his companies for his own company failure. Personally, I don't know the legal situation, but I know the moral one. And I had a look at some of my suppliers' terms and conditions, and most of them claim to own the wines until payment has been received. But I think when a receiver comes in, everybody becomes an unsecured creditor like everybody else." Anthony Worrell Thompson was not the only celebrity chef to get into trouble. Gordon Ramsay had to inject £5 million into his company, Gordon Ramsay Holdings, to stop his businesses going under earlier in the year. Lucky for him, he has that sort of money kicking around. What's the last news story, Jane?
If you recall last week, we talked about the champagne producers possibly having to cut yields. And the industry this week has agreed to reduce yields and cut production by 40% for the 2009 harvest to satisfy demands of the big houses to not add surplus supplies to already high stocks and therefore preserve prices. The basic yield has been set at 8,000 kilos per hectare, but growers will be allowed to pick up to 9,700 kilos. The average yield last year was 14,200, which produced 405 million bottles of champagne. Now, this next bit's a bit confusing. As part of the deal, champagne houses will only have to pay for the 8,000 kilograms per hectare of grapes in their usual quarterly payments over the 12 months after the harvest. But they will also pay the growers for the additional 1,700 kilos per hectare in the November of the following year. The houses are only allowed to bottle the 8,000 kilos per hectare, while the extra 1,700 remain declassified until October of the following year. Finally, growers which own over 90% of the vineyards in Champagne will be allowed to bottle the full yield of 9,700 kilos per hectare immediately after the harvest. Well, that's it from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk to get these stories in full.
Wow, that's a complicated set of rules. So you can harvest more than the maximum, but it's declassified till the next year unless you own 90% of the land. I suppose this is to help small owner producers rather than the big brands who buy in their grapes and wine. Either way, it's not a good thing. Leaving grapes on the vine does nothing for quality. In fact, it can encourage moulds and mildews in the vineyard. Perhaps what they should have done was had a green harvest early, straight after bud burst, thus ensuring less grapes, but often of a higher quality or at least higher ripeness. One last point to make is congratulations to Isabel Legeron. You may recall she was on our show way back in show number 34 in January 2007. Isabel was studying for her Master's of Wine and she spoke to us about studying for it. Well, 2.5 years later, she's finally passed, along with a group of 8 in total, to become the new Masters of Wine. 280 of them in total now in the world. Good work, Isabel. One thing that Isabel would have needed was a couple of great wine books. And next up in our spotlight, we're going to be reviewing Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia. So, let's have a look at Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia, 4th edition by Tom Stevenson. The Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia is a weighty tome of 664 pages. It follows the standard shape of having a chunk of introduction pages, 39 in total, and then divides the world into countries and regions. Each region gets a brief description followed by a very good selection of the top producers to look out for from that region. The introduction, not surprising given it's a book branded by Sotheby's The Auction House, starts with a couple of pages on wine auctions, before running through a fairly standard sections on how to taste wine, terroir and viticulture. I did find the sections on oak really interesting and an excellent description of different types of soils and quite an interesting section on trellising. But how does it stack up as a reference book? On a recent trip to Burgundy and Northern Italy, I think you might have known about that one, I took this book along with Hugh Johnson's Wine Atlas and Oz Clark's Wine Atlas. While I read sections from all three books, including the Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia, I tended to find Hugh Johnson and Jensen Robinson's Wine Atlas the most useful. The maps in the encyclopedia are okay, but not outstanding, and the text is concise if somewhat short. What the Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia has over other wine atlases and encyclopedias is its description on the wineries. This has by far the best coverage of wineries, with short but useful descriptions. And for the countries I know a reasonable amount in, I tend to agree with as well as them being the top producers. It is this that separates Tom's book from the competition, who usually only have a couple of cursory recommendations of producers from each region. Interestingly, Tom doesn't claim to have tasted all the recommended producers, but at least he's honest about this. In the auction world, Bordeaux is king, and at 72 pages, or just over 10% of the book, it is the book's key region. France, like most of these wine atlases, dominates the book with 207 or 36% of the book dedicated to wine regions. As a consequence, Italy, which for me is a hard region which I need more information on, has a paltry 39 pages. Spain, 25, and America gets a huge 72 pages, and I think this highlights the importance of the American market to Sotheby's. New Zealand, one of my favourite countries, being from there, has a dignified 18 pages, while Australia gets 48 pages. Surprisingly, Tom gives quite a good description to minor regions such as Queensland's viticultural regions in Australia. And finally, being a bit biased, being the UK Wine Show, Tom's coverage of the UK wine scene is certainly the best of all atlases and encyclopedias we've come across so far. The focus on producers is what gives Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia an interesting variant on the general wine atlas scene, and I think makes a useful second world reference book. It's the lack of high quality detailed maps and too brief a description on wine regions, which means unless you like to drop lots of names about chateaus here and there and there, it shouldn't be your primary source of information about wine regions. But as a book, it complements wine atlases such as Hugh Johnson and Oz Clark's, and I would recommend it to any enthusiastic student or possibly wine investor who would find the description on producers very useful. In the end, I rated this book 90 out of 100. That ends this week's book review in the spotlight. The next book I'm going to review is a book that came out about 6 months ago, Guide to Wines of England and Wales. Next week in the spotlight, we're going to be looking at bulk wines, what they are, what they're good for. But before we get into our interview with Roger Bego from Duval Loire on their new wine closure, let's have our next mystery clue for the wine region. The wine region is divided up into four regions, where Maipo and Rapel are the two most significant. Soils vary depending on the area, and there are distinctions climate-wise. Generally, however, the area is a Mediterranean climate with warm, dry summers and winter rainfall of between 300 and 800 millimetres, and this tends to increase in the south and the east slopes of the Andes. Apart from spectacular scenery, the mountains also bring benefits for grape growers. For example, cold air drainage from the Andes at night causes great temperature variations in the east, which gives good levels of colour and acidity to ripe grapes. Snowmelt from them, carried by the various rivers that cross the area, also provides water for irrigation during the growing season. Hope that helps. I'm going to give you the answer for that after this week's interview with Roger Bego. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, I'm here with Roger Bego. How are you, Roger?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Excellent. You're the export manager for Duval Leroy?
I'm the export director for Champagne Duval Leroy in Vertu, France.
Excellent. You pronounce it so much better than I do.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking today. Talk a wee bit about your champagnes and the different champagnes you've got, just quickly. But the thing that's of interest is you've got an unusual closure for your champagnes. Do you want to just describe what it is? And
we have a house which was founded 150 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the last big family house in Champagne. It has been transmitted from father to son for the last 150 years. We have put together with Alcan, which is a big, I think, Canadian company. They have a big factory in France. We have put together a new closure for our Champagne, which we have put on one of our best cuvées, which is called Clos des Bouvries, 2004. And this closure is without cork.
It's a bit unusual for that.
It's very unusual.
And not just that, it looks unusual as well.
Yes, because it is formed with a crown cap inside.
That's your normal beer cap.
Normal beer,
and that's the sort of stuff.
Coke, or
yeah, and that's what champagne spends its time on anyway in the cellars. Aging.
Exactly, it is aging like that on lease in the cellars, and we have a plastic lever which, in fact, lifts the crown cap, and when it does the normal pop. Exactly. That famous sound, which everybody likes to hear, because it is the beginning of a
fun.
Good time and fun. Fizz is fun, and champagne is the best.
Well, I like English sparkling wine as well. It's a good competition.
It's a good competition. But there's only champagne from the Champagne region.
Oh, no, for sure. Everything else is fizz or sparkling wine.
Or sparkling wine.
Excellent. Okay, what... We'll talk a wee bit about the performance of the closure later on, but what, as a champagne house, why did you decide to do what is quite a, it's quite a revolutionary thing in terms of changing the format?
It is the revolution. It is the revolution. I mean, we've been using cork for the last 150 years. There are three main reasons for it. Cork, as we know, is going to be limited supply.
Is it?
I mean... You know, if all the forests in northern Spain burn because of the dry heat, Cork will be finished. So cork is a natural product.
Yeah.
And we know that those natural products are in limited supply. The second reason is that, as we all know, cork can give a taste to a wine, which is not particularly nice.
Does it? I always thought it removed flavors, sculpted flavors a wee bit.
No. I mean, it does for old wines.
Yeah, not. But you're so used to it, you don't really think about it.
But for young wines, especially the New World wines, as we know, in the last 20 years, lots of them have been using screw caps.
Yeah, sure.
And the company who developed this is the same as developed the screw caps. So they have an expertise. That's why Duval Leroy, we made this agreement with them. They have the expertise. We trusted them. And they trusted us because we had the good products. Second reason is the TCA.
TCA being cork taint.
And the third is the security. A cork on a bottle of champagne can be a very, very dangerous weapon.
Yeah.
If you take it in the eye, you might lose an eye. A cork flying, as you know, champagne is served a lot on aeroplanes, in business class or first class.
Yeah, they don't serve it where I sit for some reason.
Even in first, even in tourist class on some airlines. But anyway, it can become a dangerous weapon. I have friends who have had their eye crippled because of a cork of sparkling wine or champagne.
What about oxygen changes? Because a lot of people talk about cork having quite variable oxygen ingress, you know, so the amount of oxygen that gets into the wine changes. And also, particularly old vintage champagnes do lose a bit of fizz as they age.
I think this is going to be better than the normal cork because the cork shrinks in the bottle.
Yeah.
And therefore, oxygen can get into the wine. I mean, I've opened some old bottles of red wine or even champagne where the cork had completely shrunk within the bottle.
Yeah.
And we know that all vintages of champagne have lost most of their fizz. It's not because of that that they're not good. In fact, it is very interesting to taste old champagnes. But in this case, the maker thinks that it's going to be perfectly sealed.
Okay. Let's look at the closure itself. We said it, as you said, it's got a crown seal, but it has a big piece of plastic in there as well, which isn't normally, I don't normally see that on beers anyway. I'm not sure about champagnes that have been aged, but it's got that wee bit of plastic in there.
Yes, it's the double closure, really. So you have the idea in order for the fizz to stay in the bottle. It's the perfect closure. But the other interesting part is this plastic top which you have on top, which not only makes the shape of the bottle
look like a traditional champagne.
Look like traditional, but also stops the crown seal coming out. So when you pull the lever, it stays in there, and it's actually stopped. So that is the security.
Because you got a risk of the crown seal shooting off as well.
Exactly.
And that's lighter; it'll go faster.
And it can go faster.
And made of metal.
The idea is to have your bottle of champagne always very cool.
Yeah.
And nothing can happen to it.
I noticed I had a go yesterday with one of these bottles. I've had a wee play with it. And I was a bit worried about breaking it before I'd open the closure because it feels not flimsy, but at the same time, it does. You think that the plastic is going to bend before it opens. It does open quite nicely.
That's why it's a bit long. It's because you have to take it this way from here.
Have a good lever on it, don't you? What sort of response have you had from people?
For the moment, it's quite good.
Yeah,
it's even very good. So we had a good response. Even the French press, to whom it was presented last week, who you know could be traditional sometimes.
Could be. That's a nice understatement, Roger.
Could be traditional. The French press received it quite well. Yes. We had a lunch with the French wine press and also the packaging press, and they were quite responsive. Even we had two very well-known sommeliers around the table, and they found it very, very interesting.
Part of the ritual of opening champagne is to remove the foil and remove the wire cage and all that sort of palaver. Do you think you lose a wee bit of that with this? Or
no, because, I mean, it will be so so easy to do. And think about all the ladies who are afraid of opening a bottle of champagne because, you know, this thing is going to pop all around, etc.
Some women don't have the strength.
They don't have the strength. This makes it very easy.
Yeah. So it is actually quite easy to lift off.
Our chairman is a lady. So we have... She always said, but, you know, even with the age, I don't have the strength of doing this. And with this, it makes life very, very, very easy.
Excellent. Excellent. You've got it on one of your bottles now, one of your top bottles?
We got it on the Clos des Bouvries, which is our Clos, which has been in our family for more than 50 years, very old vines. It's a pure Chardonnay, and the year on this bottle is 2004.
So it's quite a young wine.
It's quite a young wine, but it is also a very, very dedicated wine.
I tried it yesterday, actually, and I thought it was quite nice.
Three hectares, 30,000 bottles only. So it's very limited supply. And in fact, we did the experiment for 2,000 bottles only. So, but the next one, we think we're going to use the crowns, the open concept, as we call it.
Is that what you call it, open concept?
We call it open concept.
Okay, not crown seal, because it's not really a crown seal. No, it's a bit more complicated than
concept.
That. Okay. And what sort of price compared to a normal cork is this?
That claim is going to be the same.
Okay, so in the long run with
volume. In the long run with volume, it's going to be the same.
Okay, excellent. And are you going to put it on other of your brands? Or?
Yeah, we would like to put it on our next vintage, which is going to be 1999. At the moment, it's only designed to go on a normal 75 centiliters, but I bet they're going to do it for magnums and halves and all the different shapes of a bottle of champagne.
Sure, because it's mainly just the top that you're worried about rather than...
Yeah, but also the size of the bottle.
Yeah, yeah.
The neck of the bottle.
Yeah, sure. Sure, it makes sense. All right, then. Well, good luck with this,
Thank
Roger.
Thank you very much.
And hopefully we'll see a bit more of this in the future.
Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed the interview. The closure is effectively just a beer cap with a fancy plastic arm to take it off. Whether you need such a sophisticated closure, I don't know. Certainly it gives a nice form to the closure rather than just having a normal beer cap on top, but I'm torn. Next week, we're going to be interviewing Zork. They've got a new champagne stopper or fizzy wine stopper, which I think has some practical advantages over this closure. So stay tuned for that next week. But before we finish up, how are you getting on with the mystery wine region? Well, it is Chile's Central Valley. Let me give you the clues again. Chile's Central Valley is the source of majority of the country's wine. It's 1,000-kilometer-long plateau which is separated from the Pacific Ocean to the west and the low coastal range of peaks, while to the east are the mighty Andes, rising to 6,000 meters. Vines at altitude of up to 600 meters on the western slopes and 1,000 meters on the sunnier eastern side. It was thought that the vines were brought to the Central Valley as early as 1554 by Spanish settlers, partly so that they could make wine which could be used in the Eucharist. However, today, different set of grape varieties are grown. Red grapes such as Cabernet Sauvignon, Carmenere, Merlot and Syrah dominate, but Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay are also important. The Central Valley is divided up into four key subregions and then further subregions within that, with Maipo and Rupel being key regions. Soils are varied depending on the area and there are distinct climates within there. Generally, however, the Central Valley is considered Mediterranean with warm, dry summers and winter rainfall of between 300 and 800 millimetres, although this does tend to increase in the south and east on the slopes of the Andes. Apart from some spectacular scenery, the mountains also bring the benefits for grape growing. For example, cold air drainage from the Andes at night causes temperatures to be quite variable to the east, which gives good level of acidity and colour to the ripening grapes. Snowmelt from them, carried by the various rivers that dissect the Central Valley, also provides water for irrigation during the growing season. So, That's your clues for the Central Valley and Chile. Hope you got that. One last thing before we finish up is the quote. And this week it's a nice quick one from another poet, a guy called John Gay, an English poet and dramatist. From wine, what sudden friendship spring. Quite nice. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.